The lovely Linda Ronstadt and the Stone Ponies. A Different Drum. That song was actually written by Michael Nesmith of the Monkees. All right, we are about to embark on a remarkable two-hour journey analyzing the historical and archaeological evidence. Xavier Hayes is about to provide some pretty compelling evidence that our ancestors in the ancient Americas were much taller and a lot more mysterious than we can imagine. Their exploits inspired the Native Americans to keep oral accounts of these mysterious giants who left behind strange artifacts, massive cities of burial mounds, and the remains of a vast copper mining network. Who were these ancient giants? Did some really have six fingers and six toes? Were some related to the elongated skull peoples of Peru? Your view of American history will never be the same after we go down the giant rabbit hole that is Ancient Giants of the Americas, when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Xavier Hayes is a researcher, teacher, and archivist of ancient manuscripts with a keen interest in lost civilizations, ancient aliens, ancient giants, and the myths of the pre-Diluvian world. He's the author of 10 books, including The Suppressed History of America. XavierVision.com, his free online library, is one of the most complete collections of metaphysical, spiritual, and alternative history books and podcasts in the world. He resides in a haunted house in Miami, Florida, and his latest is Ancient Giants of the Americas. Xavier Hayes, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
One of my favorite stories sort of in this Ancient Giants arena has to do with Abraham Lincoln. And he's in Niagara Falls. He's not yet president. I believe he's campaigning for somebody else. And he delivers this speech as he's gazing out at the this marvelous, you know, this marvel of nature, the falls. Niagara, he says, calls up the indefinite past. When Columbus first sought this continent, when Christ suffered on the cross, when Moses led Israel through the Red Sea, nay, even when Adam first came from the hand of his maker, then as now, Niagara was roaring here. Here's where it gets interesting. The eyes of that species of extinct giants whose bones fill the mounds of America have gazed on Niagara as ours do now. Was Abraham Lincoln a believer in ancient giants, or was he talking about, I don't know, some have suggested he was referring to the bones of mastodon, perhaps buried in those mounds. What are your thoughts?
He definitely was a believer in ancient giants, and being tall himself, he found it very interesting growing up around the mound area of the Ohio Valley. He had other journeys to investigate, personal journeys to check these out, and he was pretty convinced that there was a race of giants, especially since he was up to date on the folklores of the native. So he definitely thought there was something to do with the mounds. Most in that time actually kind of did. You know, this is the before Darwinism, when the Mastodon discoveries were still fresh. You know, during the Lewis and Clark days, they thought they would still discover Mastodons out west, and even giants, and the Mandan Indians, which were a Welsh tribe. So Lincoln definitely had a grand concept of this pre-Diluvian ancient culture that once had been in the Americas.
What's fascinating, Xavier, is if you go through the archives of, I'm not sure if the New York Times is included here, but a lot of what I would have thought would have been reputable papers at the time were, and this is early 20th century, early 1900s, printing or publishing stories of anthropologists, archaeologists uncovering giant skeletal remains. These were being published in the newspapers of the day. It was almost, dare I say, commonplace.
Yes, before the fake news was out of control, the Washington Washington Post and the New York Times published a fair amount of giant related articles. And, you know, this actually happened worldwide as well. In Europe and England, plenty of cases of giant discoveries, giant graveyards. I was recently in Bristol, and there's actually an area near the bridge over there that has the Giant's Cave. And according to local folklore, there were two giants who lived in Bristol before they were ran out of town by the Normans or whoever. And for £5, you could go down into this one of the Giant's Caves of Bristol. And you notice when you get down there, it's a little cramped. And, you know, I'm about almost 6'1", so when I got into the actual space where the so-called giants were, I don't see how they could I didn't see how they could have fit. But it was very interesting. I think they have the local tradition correct, but maybe the wrong cave. But anyone in Bristol, England, should check it out. It's very interesting. And as far as in America, you know, the like I said, the Native American histories, all about ancient giants. And there's a few subcategories as well. You mentioned the six-finger ones and this cannibalistic red-headed race that we find popping up in different mythos of different Native American tribes.
Now, how do we know when we're talking about giants and unearthing these skeletal remains of giants that were 7 feet, 8 feet, that we're not talking about isolated incidents, an overactive pituitary gland, for example? I mean, there are cases of, you know, of people being that tall, but to suggest that they're an entire race of giants that are 8 feet or taller, I mean, how do we differentiate between a pituitary case and an actual giant?
Well, that's a good question, and unfortunately, science has deemed that we really can't, because according to them, ancient giants, you know, was never really a thing. So any sort of larger-than-average skeleton, they're always going to contribute it to this pituitary gland defect. But there's so much evidence of giant skeletons that it would just be foolish to think that every single one of them is because of this. You know, during westward expansion, a lot of the mounds were excavated. And even some of the first reports from the Smithsonian, like basically the first book I think they ever published, had to do with excavating mounds. And during these reports, they found a bunch of skeletons that at least were 7.5 feet tall, like starting out. So when you have hundreds of skeletons that range between 7.5 feet tall to 9 feet, it's kind of hard to say every single one had to do with the pituitary gland. And in the case of the native tribes, what we find is the chiefs always were the tallest. So we think that this has to do with keeping this genetic lineage that had been passed down alive.
So were these giants, were they themselves indigenous, or because you mentioned, according to the oral tradition of some of these tribes, that these giants were red-haired, which would suggest perhaps that they came from Europe or some other place. I mean, what are we talking about? Where did they come from?
Yeah, and this is the question, and this is why, you know, when they, excuse me, you know, when they mentioned the missing link, you know, you got to start wondering if this giant, you know, presence was the missing link or has something to do with it, because you talk about this, you know, the red-headed giants, right, which quite a few of the tribes mentioned. Now, these sort of the the hybrid Neanderthal subspecies that emerged from like the Denisovans, from the other humanoids that don't belong to the hominid family, but are part of the, you know, the same type of, we're on the branch, right? So you got the Denisovans who are at least 30,000 years old. And, you know, science has already discovered that there's an unknown DNA, you know, that they're interbreeding with some other sort of hominid that we can't, like, we don't know about. So, excuse me, it makes it really interesting to think that the giants are involved in this sort of mass interbreeding of the species of ancient times.
Can you walk us through some of the early or some of the finds here in North America that were reported in newspapers in the early 20th century? Give us, you know, some of the locations and what was actually unearthed. Some examples.
Well, I have to check out the book to get specifics. Here's one, for example. Big skeletons in the Bronx. Workmen grading 10th Avenue extension through the northernmost end of Manhattan Island. During the past week, unearthed portions of about a dozen ancient human skeletons in a little knoll about where 211th Street will someday run. Some were nearly complete, but others had to have been interred in an upright position with the heads about 3 feet from the surface. Bronx measurements of one skeleton of the man represents more than 8 feet tall.
And these were uncovered in the Bronx, in present-day Bronx, New York.
Yep, and this was 1897.
And that was published in what paper, do we know?
In the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Wow. So, the million-dollar question is, you know, why aren't we finding these skeletons in the Smithsonian? Well, what happened? Is there a paper trail that tells us what happened to these skeletal remains? Were they shipped to museums?
Yeah, in the book, you could read about how most cases, when you see that, hold on, yeah, get over cold, so like this, get like the dry throat attack. Forgive me. So, in most cases, these huge reports will come out, and you'll read about how they discovered giant bones, giant skeletons, really crazy. They're usually super excited during this discovery phase. And what happens is, somewhere towards the end of the article, it always mentions bones were shipped off to the Smithsonian. And without fail, that's usually where the trail ends. So many instances that you can totally read that lead all the way to the Smithsonian being involved, either them coming confiscating or the bones being shipped to them. And then you never hear from it again.
That's where the trail ends and runs cold.
That's where it ends. And this is over and over and over again from reports since, you know, the 1800s up until the early 1940s.
Xavier Hayes is with us, and the book is Ancient Giants of the Americas, Suppressed Evidence and the Hidden History of a Lost Race. The book begins with a chapter on this immense, sophisticated copper mining operation on the shores of Lake Superior. How did the giants figure into that?
Well, basically, we don't know where most of the copper came from. During this age?
During the Bronze Age, right.
During the Bronze
Age,
right.
There's not enough copper in Europe to account for all of the bronze, exactly. So they had to get it from exactly. Somewhere.
Now, we see this in Michigan, the Chicago area, all of this vast network of a copper mining operation. And according to, again, the myths of the local Indians, this had been done by the giant, the red-headed giant. And you could even find you know, hieroglyphs or petroglyphs of big ships. Huge, they found big axes. Big, you know, big steps in that area to go along with the myth of this so-called race. And a lot of people might even think it's the Phoenicians or the Vikings had come down. But, you know, according to the local legends, it was the giants. And, you know, these giants had come far down into Nevada area. We think that, according to the Paiute Indians there, who discovered the giants in the Lovelock Cave in Nevada, you know, the oldest duck decoy in the world. So this is during a time when there was actually water around this area. And they had the same legends, red-headed giants. So, you know, it's possible that they had started out and expanded down from the north, from these copper mining areas.
Did the various tribes in North America, did they war with the giants, or was there a peaceful coexistence?
No, basically, most of the giants were cannibals. So it was constantly a battle with them stealing the children and stuff. So
the giants were stealing the children of the various tribes and eating them.
Yeah, and you know, it even goes further back, because most of the myths, again, you know, the giants were, most of them were like, you know, the boogeyman to children, in a sense, because you know, they're much feared. They would steal the children because they were cannibals.
Is there any anthropological or archaeological evidence for this cannibalism amongst the giants, or does this mainly come from the oral tradition of the indigenous people?
It comes from the oral tradition. Yeah, but by the time the giants had dwindled so much, you know, up until when the conquistadors came, there wasn't too many of them. They had been mostly murdered, but up until that time, they'd been cannibals. And you know, from South America to Mexico and North America, even Canada.
So how widespread were these giants in the New World? Did their range extend all the way down to into South America?
Yeah, they were all over. I mean, the bottom tip of Patagonia, like in Argentina, that leads to the Arctic, which is where some of the last were discovered.
You mentioned the conquistadors, the Spanish. Are there accounts from the conquistadors of encounters with giants?
Yeah, the conquistadors left us the greatest record of giant encounters.
Tell me about that.
We have firsthand accounts from them. Cabaca de Veza, you know, wrote one of the most famous ones of going through in Florida, up into Tampa Bay area, and they encountered giant Indians who were shooting huge arrows at them with a force they had never seen before. So they documented some of the first ones, and you know, then it led into De Soto's march up into, you know, Alabama and Mississippi looking for the mighty Chief Tuscaloosa.
All right, Xavier, we're going to take a time out here. You get yourself a lozenge and a glass of water. Take care of that throat. We'll come back and continue to discuss ancient giants of the Americas. Here are the Beatles and Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite from Sgt. Pepper's here on Coast to Coast AM. And this is the barrel-chested troubadour from Sheffield, England, Joe Cocker. Ever find yourself caught up in a vivid memory of an event that you later realize with confusion didn't really happen the way you thought? Well, according to new research by psychologists at the University of Warwick in the UK, you are far from alone. The study demonstrated that about half of individuals will come to believe a fictional event occurred if they're told about that event and then repeatedly imagine it happening. You can read more about this fascinating study in the news section at coasttocoastam.com, where our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, has posted that and much more. We'll get back to our conversation with Xavier Hayes, author of Ancient Giants of the Americas. A lot of famous explorers apparently had encounters with giants, including Vespucci and Magellan and more. Just a reminder that a novel is now available at Amazon.com by our very own George Norrie. It's about a late night talk show host fascinated by the paranormal. He becomes entangled in a deadly conspiracy. That's Night Talk, a novel from the number one all night radio host, George Norrie. Order it now, and it should arrive before Christmas from Amazon.com. Back with more on Ancient Giants here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto Affiliate Talk Radio AM 640. Let me crib here from Xavier Hayes' Ancient Giants of the Americas. In the summer of 1579, north of San Francisco, English explorer Sir Francis Drake made contact with a tribe of giant Indians who were so excited to see the navigator that they proclaimed him a god and adorned him with a giant feathered strewn crown. In his diary, Drake recalled the few days he spent with these Indians while describing them as very tall and possessive of Herculean strength. In 1911, the Oakland Tribune reported on some of the earliest Indian artifacts found in California. These artifacts once belonged to a giant Indian tribe that lived near the shores where Drake had his encounter with giant Indians 300 years earlier. Okay, so Xavier, I'm a little confused because on the one hand, we have these red-headed giants who the indigenous people are talking about as if they are outsiders coming from some other place. And then we have accounts from explorers like Drake who seem to be talking about Indian giants. So was there an intermingling of the races or what's going on here exactly?
Yeah, it seems to be intermingling, and it seems that the red-headed giants were a subgroup that might have been more related to the Neanderthals. So they are maybe an older hybrid. And, you know, I don't think as sparsely populated as some of the rest of the giants that we see. And, you know, these natives, they're all kind of, you know, they're all kind of related to this unknown sort of genetic race of the giants. So, but the ones that, like the conquistadors were finding, definitely not for part of the red-headed race, and a lot younger as well.
It's remarkable. I wasn't aware that these encounters with giants had been actually recorded in their journals by the most famous explorers. Tell me about Vespucci, Amerigo Vespucci. I mean, the North American continent and the South American continent was named after this explorer Vespucci. Tell me about his encounters with giants.
Well, this is the best part of my book, that I include a lot of first-person encounters and first-person narratives, which makes it a lot more interesting. Now, Vespucci, we know, was the Italian merchant, born in Florence in 1545. He had good connections, which allowed him to explore the New World. And basically what his giant encounter, which he gave a fabulous report of, appeared in the island we now call Carousel, which is off the coast of Venezuela. And in the second voyage of Amerigo Vespucci, translated from the original text by Oxford scholar Clements Markham in 1893, he describes how we found that this other island was inhabited by very tall people. We landed to see whether there was any fresh water, and not thinking it was inhabited, as we had not seen anyone, we came upon very large footprints in the sand. As we were walking along the beach, we judged that if the other measurements were in proportion to those feet, then they must be very tall. when we had gone about a league, we saw five huts, which appeared to be uninhabited, in a valley, and we went to them. But we only found five women, two old and three children of such lofty stature, for sure, the wonder of the thing. We wanted to keep them. So he discovers these tall native girls, and their first reaction is, okay, we got to kidnap these girls. And he continues to write, while we were forming this design, there entered by the door of the hut as many as 36 men, much bigger than the women, and so well made that it was a rare thing to behold. They carried very large bows and arrows and great clubs with knobs. They talked among themselves in a tone as if they wished to destroy us. We called this island the Island of Giants by reason of their stature. So seeing they were vastly outnumbered and outsized, they kind of escaped peacefully, got back on their boat, fired off a few cannons, and sailed off from the Island of Giants, which is now the Carousel Island.
You also talk about another famous explorer, Magellan, a great title here for this chapter, Magellan's Magical Mystery Tour and the Giants of South America. Tell me about Magellan's encounters with giants.
Well, Magellan had been going to basically also looking for Patagonia and on the southern coast of Argentina. John Cabot, the English sailor, he was also looking for this. So while wintering in Argentina Harbor near the Arctic at the bottom of South America, Magellan and his crew had their first encounters with the Patagonia giant. Pigafetta was his chronicler, and one of the few people that survived the Magellan expedition. And Magellan writes, but one day, without anyone expecting it, we saw a giant who was on the shore near today's Puerto San Julian, Argentina. He was quite naked, and who danced, leaped, and sang. And while he sang, he threw sand and dust on his head. Our Captain Magellan sent one of his men toward him, charging him to leap and sing like the other in order to reassure him and to show him friendship, which he did. Immediately, the man of the ship, dancing, led this giant to a small island where the captain, Magellan, awaited him. And when he was before us, he began to marvel and to be afraid, and he raised one finger upward, believing that we had came from the sky. And he was so tall that the tall of us only came to his waist.
Amazing. Reports that these giants had six fingers and six toes, six fingers on each hand, six toes on each foot. Is there any archaeological evidence to bear that out? Do all of the giants have six fingers and six toes?
This seems to be another subgroup of giants. I'm not sure if there are any bones that exist. I think there was some reports of this. We see it mostly in arts, in petroglyphs. We have seen some six-fingered, six-toed petroglyphs. Curiously enough, in the Aztecs, in the Mayans, we see it. In the Bible, it's mentioned a lot. The Bible is fascinating when it comes to giants.
That's how I first became fascinated with giants. Of course, the Old Testament accounts of the Amorites and the Amalekites and of course,
yeah,
Goliath.
It's incredible because a lot of it is like, oh, we got to kill the evil giants, you know. Like even Moses, you know, it's a whole part of Moses before they even get to Israel or Jerusalem. And we had the spies sent out, and they come back as like, you know, boss, there's a bunch of giants. So like they had to. Moses had to order, you know, them to kill these giants to even...
Yeah, there's a whole lot of smiting going on in the Old Testament.
A whole lot of smiting these giants.
Yes, I want to come back to that a little bit later, but I want to get back to the some of the other unusual attributes of these giants. We mentioned the six fingers and six toes. There are also accounts of giants having double rows of teeth.
Excuse me?
Double rows of teeth. I'd heard the giants, they had discovered skeletal remains of giants, and they had two rows of teeth. So, in other words, double rows, top and bottom.
Yeah, they actually have found some of these. And, again, you know, anthropology has some fancy way to make sure it's like some anomaly. But, you know, there is this other, like subgroups of subgroups of subgroups of giants, basically, you know. The double rows of teeth, which, again, appear in the Native American histories. They mentioned them as well. Yeah, and it's another thing that, you know, we're discovering constantly new humanoid species, and, you know, new ancestors. They found some bones in Ethiopia. They're like 3 million years old. That they don't know who they were, but they're all part of this branch of tree. Of the human tree, you know, which includes this giant race and the sub-categories of the giant race, of which you have the six fingers, six toes, you got the double rows of teeth. You know, the fact that most of it's hidden or covered up, it does a disservice to all of us. You know, we want to see the bones, we want to see the proof, more than just oral histories. So it's a you know, it's part of all of our history. It's a shared history for all of us. You know, I think we have the right to know this.
Well, I understand on a certain level why the suppression. If you think about evolutionists or Darwinists, man is supposed to start off shorter and get taller when you think of evolution, right? But if you have humans starting off taller and getting shorter, that kind of throws a wrench into the whole theory, doesn't it? I mean, could that be one of the reasons why this is being suppressed?
Well, yeah, it's one of the reasons, and, you know, I think evolution exists to a certain point. The problem is they have a lot of issues, you know, with this missing link, you know, and exactly how all this happened, you know. You know, the apple cart doesn't like being upset, you know, because then not only is it evolution theories and academia and how all academia is basically set up for this system. You know, if you're a professor, you have to basically teach what you're taught and told to teach, right? You go off.
Yeah, they don't. These skeletons don't fit with the narrative, and therefore, you know, you can't put them on display. Only things that fit with the narrative.
Rebel and then lose your job, and you know, and then where are you going to work afterwards?
Right. So I'm wondering. I mean, if there were in fact, hundreds of these skeletal remains unearthed, and presumably shipped off to some museum, what do you think? Are they sitting in a back room somewhere? Are they in a big warehouse out in the desert?
I would think so. You know, I mean, according to Smithsonian, they don't have anything in their closets or in their basements. But, you know, who knows, right? Like, who, you know, could they be dumping them off in the middle of the ocean? The problem here, too, is, you know, not only do you have to worry about what the Smithsonian's hiding, but most of these artifacts will go into private collections. And, we don't know what is actually in private. You know, we don't know. Black market items, all the looting that's gone on and currently right now in the Middle East. And so, you know, it's kind of funny too that areas where all these giant histories, you know, are prevalent, we can't even visit. Most of them are being destroyed. Take, for instance, Syria with the Andera Temple. There are huge, giant footprints. I mean, right there in the stone leading up to the temple, and it's, you can see them. You know, this area has been destroyed by war. You know, there's no tourism going on, and they probably don't even want you to know that exists. But you know, it's there. You know, most of us have seen the giant footprint in South Africa that Michael Tillinger, showed. A huge footprint in the side of the mountain there. incredible. You can see it on YouTube. They're finding a giant footprint in China recently, and also in India. Plenty of areas in India, I think Lepakeshi Temple, that has ancient giant footprints. And, you know, of course, the history of India is fascinating. It's a collective history. And they're all about, you know, flying spaceships, you know, the Vimanas and giants and everything else. So, you know, this global ancient idea of giants is pretty much all over the world and, you know, much more than just myths. You know, I think most myths are based on reality anyway.
It seems to be the elephant in the room. It's this huge conspiracy that's just hiding in plain sight. As you say, the evidence is everywhere. We have all of these explorers documenting encounters with giants in their journals. We have reputable newspapers publishing accounts well into the early 19th or early 20th century of skeletal remains being uncovered, contact being made with representatives from the Smithsonian, etc. But then nothing on display. I want to get your take on the elongated skulls in Peru. L.A. Marzulli, a frequent guest on Coast to Coast, has done a lot of work investigating these skulls. Of course, he has a very different take on what these skulls are, and we can get into that perhaps a little later. But what are your takes? What is your take on these elongated skulls in Paracas?
Very interesting, because you find elongated skulls all over the world as well, and not just the binding type, which again is, why are they binding? Who are they imitating?
Right, cradle boarding, where they deliberately elongate a skull by, at a very early age, when the child's bones are pliable, they would cradle board them to stretch the skull.
And that's what they want you to think all of them are, right? So, you know, who are they imitating? And you can find these in Malta, ancient Egypt had them, you know, a lot of places have this elongated skull. Most of them are in Peru. I think they could have been related to giants at some point, or they could have been possibly reptilian, I mean, or some other sort of human hybrid or human subspecies that we don't know about that might have alien DNA or something, you know?
Right, so now we're getting into LA's territory, which is, you know, the Nephilim, that the giants were the offspring of the fallen angels.
Right, because the Nephilim were the offspring, and then you have the giants. And all of the cultures talk about giants being destroyed. You know, not just in the biblical areas, but, you know, the natives. Like, when we talk about, in the native myths, when they talk about the cannibalistic giants, pretty much they always end it with the Great Spirit having to destroy them because they were wicked. Echoes what we hear in, you know, in the Bible. So...
So you're open to the idea then, Xavier, that the giants that inhabited ancient North America and South America and the world, really, these giants may not have been fully human. You're open to that idea.
Well, I think, I mean, that's kind of what all the scriptures say, basically, you know. Even the natives, they're all open to aliens and, you know, the Sky Brothers. So they don't, you know... To me, I have no problem. It seems to be like that's actually, if we decode it and actually read it with open mind, that's kind of what they're saying, you know? Genetic experiments, genetic engineering, you know, that's kind of what, and if you read it how it's supposed to be read, that's what it says, especially when it talks about the Nephilim and the giants.
It certainly explains why there was a whole lot of smiting going on in the Old Testament when God would order the Israelites to go into a particular village and destroy every male, female, and offspring. If we are talking about the Nephilim, a hybrid human and fallen angel, that would explain why that wickedness had to be eradicated. We will come back and continue to discuss ancient giants of the Americas with Xavier Hayes, and taking us into the break, Sly and the Family Stone's take on Doris Day's Que Sera Sera, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us.